This is Speaking of Faith's Unheard Cuts. I'm Krista Tippett. You're listening to my unedited conversation with Michael McCullough, author of Beyond Revenge, The Evolution of the Forgiveness Instinct. I spoke with him using a broadcast-quality telephone connection on August 29th, 2008. I was in the studios of American Public Media in St. Paul, Minnesota, and he was in the studios of WLRN in Miami, Florida. This interview was included in our program, Getting Revenge and Forgiveness, originally podcast in November 2008. Download the MP3 of the produced show at speakingoffaith.org. Hello?
Hello.
Hi.
Hi there.
It's Krista Tippett.
Hi, it's Mike McCullough. How are you?
I'm glad to have you at the other end of the microphone.
Likewise.
Do you have any questions of me before we begin? Are you familiar with the show at all?
Yeah, I've heard it a few times.
Okay. Do you have anything I can answer? Or?
I don't think so. Colleen gave me a feel for some directions you want to take this, and that all sounds great with me.
Okay.
So.
I want to talk to you about the things you're thinking about all the time anyway. And I really like in your book the mix of science and social science and stories, real world stories, and and also even I would say this is kind of a characteristic of our show. Even when you're not speaking about yourself, I think your personal passion and interest for the subject comes through, that you that you care about this, that you have a stake in it. So that's important to me too. And whoever you want to emphasize that is fine as well.
Great. Yeah.
Sorry.
That's true.
Somebody's saying, what are you saying, Mitch? No, I'm fine. I think we're okay. Okay. All right. It's Friday afternoon and it's been a long week. And so you sound really energetic and I'm going to soak that up from you.
Well, you know, it's just another day down here in Nirvana for us.
Right. Okay, well, can we go, Mitch, do you think? Okay. And this is not live, so we don't have to, we get to have a real conversation, which can be messy and circular if it needs to be.
Sure.
Okay. I do like to start, whoever I'm speaking with, whatever we're speaking about, I'd like to ask you to just tell me something about the religious background of your life, of your childhood. Was there one?
I was raised Southern Baptist.
Me too.
And attended a Southern Baptist church with my family all the way into high school, actually, into junior high and the early high school years.
Okay.
That was a formative 15 or 16 years there.
Okay. And then how did you come to be working academically at the convergence of psychology and religious studies? I mean, it seems to me you are really a psychologist, but you're also teaching in the Department of Religious Studies. Is that right?
I do. I teach a course in our religious studies department over at the University of Miami.
Mm-hmm.
I saw with my own eyes that religion was important to the decisions people make and the choices they have and the emotions they feel. And I just knew that somewhere in the field of psychology, there was somebody who studied that. And there was somebody doing science on that. And so I really wanted to do that as a psychology major in university myself. I just knew that if I looked hard enough, I could find somebody who could teach me how to do science on that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. And that wasn't really part of the curriculum as offered, the standard curriculum.
Not at all. And in fact, one of the things that sort of surprised me was how hard it was to actually find somebody who was willing to discuss psychology and religion in the same breath.
Mm-hmm.
Psychology has traditionally been pretty skeptical of religion and has tended to turn kind of a suspicious eye toward the motives of people who are religious. And, I'd say not without cause.
Mm-hmm.
And by the same token, I think religious
people... Okay, sorry,
tended...
we're getting a funny sound in the recording and we're not sure. Did you hear anything? I know.
No.
Okay. Yeah, we're hearing it at this end. You faded in and out and got... Okay, Mitch says it's what? A dirty pot?
Oh.
Whatever that means. It's an engineering term.
Hi, it's Peter.
Hi.
We haven't experienced that problem with this console, and I haven't been adjusting the pot, I don't think.
Pod, okay. Pot. All right.
Pot. No, pot would make sense.
Okay.
Potentiometer. Yeah. I may have edged you down just a little bit, and Mitch, if you're listening, tell me if this is, I'll be quiet and tell me if this is making any noise. Did you hear anything there?
Mitch, yeah. You did hear something?
Okay, then I'll leave this alone. It's just that the level seemed to need a little adjustment here, and I brought them down a little bit. So I'll leave them alone now. I know where they are, and let's see if we can continue without problems.
Okay.
Just let me know if you need.
Yeah,
me.
It wasn't constant. It just suddenly started happening intermittently, last minute or two. Oh, okay. So I've had conversations these years with people working in many disciplines, and I mean, I think it's true across our disciplines, in medicine in general, in science in general, in social sciences, in law schools, right? That religion was kind of written out of the curriculum, and now there do seem to be people coming up who are saying, "Well, this is part of life, so how might it be integrated?"
That's right. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that's happening in psychology is, I think over the last 10 years, given the turn of geopolitical events, scientists of all stripes, social scientists of all stripes, are finally realizing that they simply can't ignore the religious motivation anymore. Mm-hmm. If you want to understand violence, terrorism, prejudice, the kind of things that send nations to war, you really do have to understand what religion is about, which is not always easy because we social scientists tend to be not very religious ourselves.
Right.
So it's really an exciting time to be interested in all things religious.
This is great. And Mitch is saying that we're also having some... So I'm sorry about this.
That's okay.
I don't want to lose any of this.
He doesn't want to lose it. Okay,
yeah.
He's checking one thing. I'm sorry.
No problem. Where are you today?
We are in St. Paul.
Oh, great.
And the Republican convention is coming here next week, and our building is getting progressively locked down and secured, and it's a little bit eerie.
What? No, why is that?
Well,
why
because the convention is right here in downtown St. Paul, where our headquarters are, where our studios are.
Uh-huh.
And so the whole downtown is becoming secured, and then we're going to be...
You're worried about protesters.
Even think it's protesters. I think it's, Secret Service, securing the perimeter of where the convention is going to be. And then also our building is going to be used by all kinds of journalists, and so there are security guards at every door, and it's a very strange atmosphere. So what do you think, Mitch? You want to hear? Can you? All right. So you were saying people are. It's like you don't want to hear anything substantive. Okay. What did you have for lunch, Mike?
Oh, I had 3 soft tacos today, and it was a religious experience.
How's that?
It wasn't really. I just thought I'd keep with the theme of the show a little bit. If I could, they were just okay.
Okay, you're in Miami, is that right?
Yeah, that's right.
How long have you been there?
This is the beginning of our 7th year in Miami, and we've really loved it.
Okay, all right. I think we can keep going now. So you're saying, do you remember where you were? You were saying that it's an interesting time.
Yeah. I think one of the things you're seeing in psychology and sociology and really a lot of the social sciences is that religion and its effects on people's behavior and their minds and the way they think about themselves and other people in the world just can't be ignored anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So I see a lot of – when I go to scientific meetings, I meet a lot of psychologists running around trying to – get get educated about what religion is. I really do, you know. And some of the best attended symposia that I see at scientific meetings now are about religion.
Mm, interesting.
And, and it's so odd because, you know, 10 years ago, this wouldn't be what you'd see. Those would be some of the most poorly attended meetings. They'd be scheduled for 9:30 on Sunday morning, you know, when most people have already gone back home.
Right.
You know, but that's just not the case anymore. Uh-huh. Religion is too important now for social scientists to ignore.
Mm-hmm. And you are doing your research, or particularly this book of yours is focuses on the subjects of revenge and forgiveness, which are important categories in geopolitical affairs and human life, and also both have a real religious resonance. And I think one of the important themes that comes through that I just, you know, I think it's important for us to talk about to lay the groundwork for what you have to say, what you're learning, is that we, and I mean, you know, we lay people, citizens, consumers of science and journalism, have to open our imaginations to think in new ways about subjects like revenge and forgiveness, that there are certain boxes into which we've put these things. And, you know, I have to say that for myself, something I've thought a lot about in recent years is how media, you know, my profession of journalism is complicit in this. Because in the news, the headlines tend to focus on and tell and retell stories of atrocity, murder, and violent revenge, you know, based on real or perceived fears or hurts. And these are, in fact, you know, exceptional stories, but cumulatively, because they tend to dominate headlines, they skew our sense of what is normal about human nature and to be expected. And then, you know, what you kind of helped me see is that that this is, in a sense, a reflection of some of the ways evolutionary biology has tended to think of this as well.
That's right. One of the things that got me writing Beyond Revenge, actually, was a dissatisfaction with the kind of boxes that we all tend to put revenge and forgiveness in as human dispositions. So if you turn on the news, you see certainly senseless acts of revenge. But we don't really know what to do with those once we see those acts. What are the stories we tell ourselves about what causes those acts? What kind of judgments do we pass about the people who commit them? Do we demonize them? Do we call them animals? Do we call them people who must have been born in a backwards society, some sort of sick culture? Those, I think, do tend to be the kind of conclusions we draw. And the more I read and the more I tried to dig deeply into not just the social sciences but also the biological sciences, as you say, the worse that story really seemed to fit. As it seems to me, revenge is much more deeply etched into the human mind than those kind of stories would suggest.
Right. And you know, I want to try to understand this, because you really talk about two different kind of preconceptions, or I can't tell if they're different or if they converge, and I just don't get it. On the one hand, there's this idea that we can get that, you know, that human nature really is brutish, and that you know, positive characteristics like generosity and love and forgiveness are exceptions to human nature. And then on the other hand, there is this, what you just described, kind of what you call the disease model of revenge. This, which is more compatible with the way religious traditions tend to think about revenge, in the modern era at least, and kind of the therapeutic model. Now, do those ways of thinking come together, or do they form us at the same time?
Yeah, here's what I think we're up against.
Okay,
if you go back to the great, you know, go all the way back to the Greek tragedies, what you see the Greeks grappling with is, why revenge is so disruptive to their efforts to establish social order, right?
Mm-hmm.
See, and you know, you have these amazing stories, right? Medea, she's so angry at her husband for his unfaithfulness to her that she destroys her own children, right, as a way of trying to get back at him. And so it goes on and on throughout these great works of Western literature.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, fast forward to Elizabethan literature, again, you find revenge kind of being depicted as this force that gets the better of people and possesses their minds and gets them to do things that are going to essentially be their own undoing. And I think what we today here in 2008 tend to think from these images, which of course trickle into, you know, more popular media.
Right, and there's a Lord of the Flies,
movies and novels, and
West Side Story are some of the ones you mentioned there.
Of course.
Yeah. The Hatfields
Mad
and
Max.
The McCoys.
Yeah, that's right. Mad Max, let's see, Death Wish, you know, and on and on and on. Is that revenge is a curse or a disease or some kind of poison that gets into minds and sort of takes control of them and then wrecks individuals and wrecks societies and wrecks families. So I think that that is the metaphor that we implicitly sort of have about revenge, this thing that we're kind of cursed with.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if you take revenge as this poison or this curse or this disease, then that affects how you think about what forgiveness is as well.
Right.
And so I think the thing that we tend to assume about forgiveness is that it's a cure, right? That mm-hmm. someone came along, some Einstein of the moral realm, right? A religious leader or a spiritual leader or some wonderfully wise person in history, and discovered how powerful forgiveness could be as an antidote to this toxin or this poison.
Right.
And so we're left really, I think, now thinking about revenge and forgiveness as, in the case of revenge, something gone wrong in humanity, and forgiveness being the thing we have to learn to do because we don't know how to do it naturally.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We have to teach each other how to do it in order to contain this disease of revenge.
Extraordinary, then.
That's right. Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm. You don't know how to do it on your own. You need to read some self-help books, or you need to go to a psychotherapist,
mm-hmm.
or you need to go over here in your solitude and make yourself learn how to do this thing.
Right. So one of the things you seem to be about is reclaiming the normalcy of both revenge and forgiveness as a part of human nature. I'd like to talk about revenge first, if we could, and do it that way. I mean, what, you know, talk to me about what you know from your own research, from the other vast psychological research you've studied, and what we're learning about brain chemistry, about what, why revenge is in us and what purpose it has served, even in evolutionary terms.
Yep. Here's what you see all throughout the animal kingdom. And this is where I really got interested.
Right.
Yeah. This is what kind of hooked me into doing the research for Beyond Revenge. If you look at what causes animals to harm each other, what you find is that they get some things out of that, right? So let's say I'm a chimpanzee or some particular type of monkey. If I harm you because you've just harmed me, I seem to get some protection out of that. So one of the very important functions it seems to serve in non-human animals is an ability to defend ourselves from future harm.
Mm-hmm.
And the logic is pretty simple. Revenge acts like a tax. Right.
Hmm.
If you want to take something from me, you have to worry that I might harm you back in retaliation. And that acts like a tax. So you take the resource from me. Right.
Okay.
You take some really valuable item of food from me. If I harm you back, that's sort of, you have to deduct that from the value of the benefit. Right.
Okay.
So the process of natural selection can see how this works. And if individuals differ in their ability or their willingness to retaliate, so that these individuals that do retaliate can deter those individuals that they live with from harming them a second time, then they're going to be less likely to be taken advantage of in the future relative to those suckers out there, those doormats who will let you pick on them. So the blind force of natural selection can, in animals, non-human animals, can create vengeful creatures simply on the basis of the fact that vengeance will protect you from being taken advantage of systematically over and over and over again.
Okay. Talk about some of that research that captivated you early on. This research on animals.
Sure. One study that really got my attention was a study on chimpanzees, which showed that if a chimpanzee is harmed by an individual that it's living with, it has the ability to remember who that individual is and target aggression back at that individual in the 10 minutes, 20 minutes, hour later. And for most people, and certainly for me when I started working on this, I was surprised to know that chimpanzees had these kinds of mental abilities, right? Mm-hmm. They can recognize the individuals they live with. They have memory. They can process harm and help, right? So if you harm a chimpanzee, they remember you. They know that you're the one who did it, and they can keep sort of something up in their heads that says, I need to go back and harm that individual when I get the opportunity. Hmm. And so, yes, and what you find is that if you harm, if you're one of these chimpanzees living in this group and you harm an individual, your chances of being harmed back by that individual in the next 10, 20 minutes increase by something like 300%. Hmm. So it's if you watch this unfolding, you know, if you sat and watched chimpanzees in one of their living areas, what you would see is A harms B, right? Alan goes and harms Bob. And if you watch long enough with a keen enough eye, Bob's going to come back around when he gets his chance, and he's going to harm Alan in retaliation. So that was so astonishing to me, right, from the outset, that I had to learn more. And I wanted to know, where else do you see this in the animal kingdom? You see it in other kinds of primates, such as one type of monkey that I like a lot. This is a monkey called the Japanese macaque.
Okay.
And Japanese macaques are very status-conscious individuals, and they're very intimidated by power. Let's just put it that way. Okay. They're very intimidated by power. So if you're a high-ranking Japanese macaque and you harm a low-ranking Japanese macaque, that low-ranking individual is not going to harm you back, right? It's just too intimidating. It's too anxiety-provoking, right? But what they do instead, and this is still astonishes me, is they will find a relative of that high-ranking individual and go seek that low-ranking cousin out or nephew and harm him in retaliation.
Really?
Yeah. Huh. It's as if they're saying, you know, I can't get you back. I'm not powerful enough to get you back. But what I'm going to do is I'm going to go harm your nephew.
Now, that does sound like human behavior, doesn't it?
Right. And here's the kicker, is when they're harming this nephew, right, most of the time they're doing it while the high-ranking individual is watching.
Huh.
So they do it in plain view. They're not trying to hide this retaliation. They're displaying it. They want the high-ranking individual to know that, you know, you can harm me. I know you can harm me. I know you're more powerful than I am. But rest assured, I know how to get at what you care about and what you value.
You know, I had this realization a few years ago when we did a program on the death penalty, which was a really disturbing program to work on, because the more you get into that subject, the more complexity it seems to take on. And I remember, it's kind of like you said, it might seem simple, but it seems so stunning to me to realize that the criminal justice system and even and especially the death penalty in history was... was progress, because before there was any kind of criminal justice system, human societies regulated themselves. But precisely that kind of revenge you're describing, that revenge was the criminal justice and system, and still is in some places, I guess.
Throughout most of human history, we have not lived in complex societies with governments and states and law enforcement and prisons and contracts that we could enforce in a court to get people to do what they agreed to do. We lived in very small groups of individuals, and there were no high-level institutions like that. So the mechanism that individuals relied upon to protect themselves and to protect their loved ones and to protect their property was fear of retaliation. And if they could broadcast that fear of retaliation to the individuals they lived with, to their neighbors, to the people on the other side of the hill, and you could cultivate a reputation as a hothead, right? Mm-hmm. If you could display that kind of behavior so people knew not to mess with you, that was like an insurance policy. It was like an insurance policy. Right. So this, and you're absolutely right, Krista, about the fact that in a lot of the world, this is still law.
Right. This is law
enforcement. It is. And any time you disrupt that system of government, that system of policing, that system of law enforcement, so people can't trust that their interests are going to be protected, that desire for revenge comes back, and people will take revenge back into their own hands to protect themselves.
And you know, we're talking about retaliation, we're talking about violence of some kind. We're also talking about violence that can serve a purpose, or may be perceived as the only method for kind of keeping the peace or restoring balance. And I think you're also saying in your research that, and also in terms of what we know about the brain, that the emotions, the reactions that arise in response to grievance, are also, we are hardwired to have those reactions, that they serve a purpose. I mean, I remember Sister Helen Prejean saying to me when we did that work on death penalty, and you know, she's a great opponent of the death penalty, but she said, you know, anger is a moral response. You know?
That's right. yes, it certainly is. It is the law. Anger in response to injustice is as reliable a human emotional response as happiness is to winning the lottery, right? Hmm. Or grief is to losing a loved one. Mm-hmm. And this is again, let me give you an example from some research.
Great.
because it actually goes deeper than this. People tend to feel guilty in our society when they feel anger or the desire for vengeance. Let's say that a lot of people do, right? They're not comfortable when they feel like, boy, I'd really like to see that person harmed because of what he or she did to me. But to get to that naturalness question, again, I uncovered research that, again, was completely astonishing to me. If you look at the brain of somebody who has just been harmed by someone, right? They've been ridiculed or harassed or insulted. We can put those people into technology that allows us to see what their brains are doing, right? So we can look at sort of what your brain looks like on revenge, right? Mm-hmm. You know, this is your brain on revenge. It looks exactly like the brain of somebody who is thirsty and is just about to get a sweet drink to drink, or somebody who's hungry, who's about to get a piece of chocolate to eat.
Just like the satisfaction of a craving?
It is exactly like that. It is literally a craving. Hmm. What you see is a high activation in the brain's reward system. And what this seems to be doing is compelling us toward a goal, which is the goal of harming in kind the person who has harmed us. So again, this is one of the messages it's important for me to try to get across. The desire for revenge does not come from some sick, dark part of how our minds operate. Mm-hmm. It is as natural as the desire to get something to eat when you're hungry, mm-hmm. right? It's as wholesome as, striving to be an Olympic medalist, right? It's a craving to solve a problem and accomplish a goal. Mm-hmm. And when people do accomplish that goal, when they see their victim, their offenders suffering, it does create satisfaction and pleasure. Hmm. And I think that this brain system is doing this job, again, because this is the job that natural selection rewarded. Individuals who had some motivation to harm individuals who harmed them did better in this game of evolution that the biologists write about.
Okay. So, we don't have a Hatfields and McCoys spectacle in the United States these days, but you actually write a lot about school shootings and how you think about this revenge motivation in that context. And you also talk about how, I would say, especially with this late, with the Virginia Tech shooting, which had so much attention very recently, there was a lot of talk about him, the mental illness of the person who perpetrated that. And you still want us to take the notion of revenge in a nuanced way seriously, even when mental illness is perhaps implicated. So describe that for me.
Right. So the Secret Service did a very comprehensive study a couple of years ago of all of the school place shootings that had taken place in the United States between something like 1974 and 2000. And so this is an organization that's really good at assessing threat, right? As you know, being in St. Paul this week, that's what they do. They try to figure out where threats lie. And so they went back to try to study these cases of school place shootings. Who were the players? Who were the killers? What were their circumstances? What were they like as people? What was their mental state? And what they found was that in over 70% of those cases, one of the factors that was prompting those individuals to take their guns or their knives to school and shoot security guards or their classmates or their teachers was a desire for revenge, some kind of grudge they were holding about
something
somebody had
done. And that's the way they would describe it? They themselves use the word revenge or talk
a grudge? Revenge or grudges. Mm-hmm. I mean, they looked pretty extensively at all kinds of case materials, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. I mean, some of these people would ultimately take their own lives, so you don't have the after the fact, but you know what they told other people or you know what they left behind. But some of it's interviews. I mean, some of these these shooters do survive, and they get interrogated, and they give statements. So revenge, the desire for revenge is... Right, that's 7 out of the 10 cases. So what kind of frustrates me when I see people talking about something like the Virginia Tech shooting from last year is that the two causes that people always run to are mental illness and the readily available guns.
Okay.
Right, and both so. Don't get me wrong. These are both issues, right? They're both real issues. It's as a university professor, I can tell you that university administrators are by law in kind of a rough place regarding what they can and can't say about students at their universities because federal laws give high protections for students' privacies. So there is a real rub against for administrators and teachers and professors to not really know what they should be passing along to law enforcement or to other administrators and so forth. So that's an issue, right? Mm-hmm. The loopholes that allow people like Sung Hee Cho to go to gun shows in Virginia and pick up guns very easily and then take them to the halls of Virginia Tech and then shoot students and teachers is also a serious problem. But most people with mental illness and even most people with mental illnesses with guns don't take them to their universities or their schools to kill people.
All right.
So what I want to say is, let's dig a little bit deeper into the psychology of these shooters and these killers and figure out what is it that they've got these grudges about. Sometimes the grudges are completely meaningless. They make no sense, right, and they clearly arise out of insanity. That seems to be the case with Sung-hee Cho, okay, at Virginia Tech, as best I understand it. The kinds of resentments and desires for revenge he had were just completely misdirected. I mean, to the extent that you could ever call these sorts of acts justified, which, yeah, you never can.
Right.
There was an irrationality to his. And yet I still wonder if someone knew about this resentment that this particular student had, and knowing that he had guns easily available, and that he had this history of mental illness, mm-hmm, would the three of those facts been enough to flag this individual as somebody that needed to be,
right,
dealt with quickly and way before something like this could have taken place?
So a lot of the resentments, that the nature of those resentments, as I understand the research you summarize, is about bullying, right?
Yeah.
And feeling socially marginalized, which I guess you could say that's a kind of really mundane rivalry that happens in the context of American schools and on playgrounds and at recess.
Oh, sure. The story of the big kids, the popular kids, oppressing the small kids, mm-hmm, the unpopular kids, the misfits. I mean, this is something you see in all schools.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't think it's necessarily just an American problem either.
Right.
So you're absolutely right that bullying tends to be the precipitant for a lot of these school place shootings. In fact, this same Secret Service study found that in 61% of those cases, the perpetrators had a history in recent times of being bullied at their schools. So, you know, if you think about being the victim of bullying, what you've got is, day in and day out, often a feeling of fear, a feeling of humiliation, a fear of insecurity, an inability to obtain justice for yourself. And if you don't have a sense of access to the school administration or a sense of confidence that somebody's going to help you deal with your problems, what seems to be happening with many of these terribly unfortunate incidents is that desire for revenge gets turned into lethal action.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's hard to talk about this, even to want to explain it, because it does sound like maybe we're justifying it. We're saying these are natural vindictive impulses, and if only those other kids hadn't bullied them, right?
Right, that's right.
And we have the same problem, or a similar problem, perhaps magnified, and I'm talking about we in American culture, talking about the motivations of terrorists. Because,
yeah,
right? Because what none of us want to do is justify that, or say that anything that could have happened would justify airplanes crashing into buildings or bombs going off in marketplaces. But
that's right.
I'm very curious about how you, with all of the research you've done, have thought about this subject of revenge, both in terms of terrorism these last few years and also in terms of, you know, the American, the Western response to acts of terror, which in some ways, I guess you could say, it's a classic grievance revenge cycle, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, if you – there's a very interesting letter that you can find on the internet, and I believe it's been authenticated as having been written by Osama bin Laden in 2002. I think it's called The Letter to America. And what he's trying to do in that letter, someone may tell me this isn't authentic, but no one has so far, is that what he's trying to do is explain what 9/11 was all about. And if you read that letter, you don't even have to read it carefully, actually. If you read it even casually, what jumps out at you is that the grammar of that incident, right, the logic that was driving 9/11 was a logic of violence. a logic of retaliation. Mm-hmm. Can I start over with that?
Yeah.
Krista?
Well, yeah. Okay. Yeah. Sure.
If you read that letter by Osama bin Laden, what you find is very clearly that his understanding of why he acted the way he did was that he was seeking revenge against the West for Muslim oppression in the Middle East. So that's an uncomfortable thing to talk about, right? Mm-hmm. Because that points the finger at Western action as the cause of 9/11, and none of us want to think about that. I don't want to think about it. I don't like it. It's not a satisfactory explanation by any means. And yet, if we ignore that explanation, can we really understand what gets in the mind of a terrorist that, again, causes them to pick up razor knives, box cutters, and get on planes and take flying lessons and get into cockpits and fly planes into buildings? Mm-hmm. We can stand on the side and use the language of incomprehensible evil to try to make sense of okay. something like mm-hmm. 9/11, mm-hmm. right? We can think about those actions as having been pure evil, and they were evil. Let's mm-hmm. not forget that. Mm-hmm. But to stop there leaves you not really knowing any more than you did before you started. You certainly don't know. You're no better off in trying to stop the next 9/11. So I really do want to push people. I want to push myself to go beyond simply calling somebody or someone pure evil to getting to their motivations. So in the same way, I want to understand what motivates workplace or schoolplace shooters to pick up guns and kill their coworkers or classmates. I want to understand what makes terrorist recruiters successful in recruiting new recruits to strap bombs to their bodies mm-hmm. and then blow up buses in Tel Aviv.
And so what the particular research you do helps you see the naturalness, the potency of these instincts for vindictive behavior, for revenge, right? Is that what you're
That's
saying?
That's right.
And so
That's
you
exactly
see that
saying.
As an incredibly powerful part of human experience that is there. And so you're saying that has to be taken seriously, which is quite a different matter than justifying or not justifying something. Is that right?
Yeah. Okay. If you don't take seriously the naturalness of human beings' impulses to seek revenge when they're harmed and oppressed, you really can't understand what these events are about from the actor's perspective, and I don't think you're in a very good position to avoid them in the future.
Okay. All right. Well, and then I guess what is especially intriguing about your work as well, and perhaps even more surprising, even kind of takes us out of our boxes than the fact that revenge is natural, is that you are really suggesting also from a scientific perspective that forgiveness is also that we have a forgiveness instinct, an aptitude for forgiveness, and that has been crafted by natural selection just like revenge. So tell me about that.
Yeah, I expected to find, frankly, less research as I dug through hundreds of scientific articles on the naturalness of forgiveness. I expected to find that, maybe I could tell a good story about it, but there just wasn't anything there that I could sink my teeth into. But boy, was I wrong. As it turns out, a lot of biologists have been trying to figure out what allows human beings to be the cooperative creatures that we are. We're cooperative with each other in a way that really makes us pretty unique among mammals, for sure. You know, we cooperate with our relatives. Lots of animals do that. But we go further and we cooperate with people we've never met. We cooperate with people that we're not related to. And by virtue of our abilities to cooperate with each other, we can build magnificent cities and radio stations, and we can put on radio shows and do all kinds of wonderful things. But that ability to cooperate is a very difficult thing to explain through natural selection. But one of the ingredients you have to have to get individuals to cooperate with each other is a tolerance for mistakes. Okay.
Interesting.
You just can't get it. You can't get organisms that are willing to hang in there with each other through thick and thin and make good things happen despite the roadblocks and the bumps along the way if they aren't willing to tolerate each other's mistakes. Sometimes if we're cooperatively hunting, let's say we're some sort of animal that works together to hunt, sometimes I'm going to let you down. And maybe it's not even intentional, but I'm going to get distracted and I'm going to make a mistake. And if you take each of those mistakes as the last word about my cooperative disposition, you might just give up. And so no cooperation gets done. So really, our ability and across the animal kingdom, many animals' ability to cooperate with each other and make things happen that they can't do on their own is undergirded by an ability to forgive each other for occasional defections and mistakes.
Interesting. I mean, here's a passage from your book, which a lot of this just seems so basic, doesn't it, when you articulate it, but it's things we don't see or think about. I mean, you said that everyday acts of forgiveness are incredibly common among between people who know each other.
Right.
That, you know, we think of forgiveness as these heroic acts, and there are always these heroic examples of forgiveness. But you said, you know, we think of it as this balm for great wounds. But you said, yet in daily life, forgiveness is more often like a Band-Aid on a scrape, and at first glance, perhaps only slightly more interesting. But of course, uninteresting doesn't mean unimportant.
Right. Right. And that this again was part of. My attempt to do violence, I guess, to this metaphor of forgiveness as this difficult thing that we have to consciously practice and learn because we don't know how to do it on their own. Mm-hmm. I forgive my 7-year-old son every day, right?
Right, right.
Because he's an active, inquisitive 7-year-old who sometimes accidentally elbows me in the mouth when we're cuddling and sometimes puts crayons on the walls. And yet it seems demeaning to call it forgiveness.
Right.
I wouldn't dignify it with the term forgiveness. It's just what you do with your children, you know? Mm-hmm. You accept their limitations and you move on. He broke my tooth once when I was drinking out of a water glass.
Right,
you know, I mean,
right.
Parents have a million of these stories, right?
Right.
You don't put any effort into forgiving. Mm-hmm. It naturally happens and you move on. Mm-hmm. And there's a great evolutionary story about why it comes so easy in those kind of circumstances, too.
Mm-hmm. And which is pretty obvious, I guess, that it makes sense. I mean, it's the way you keep moving through daily life, right?
Yeah. I mean, evolution wasn't kind to individuals who would seek revenge against their genetic relatives.
Okay.
Bottom line, mm-hmm. right?
Mm-hmm.
So we have this natural tolerance for the misbehavior of our children, right? It is, at that level you're talking about, incredibly mundane, right? We put no effort into it. It happens every day 1,000 times. We would never even give it a second thought, and yet we do it over and over again.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, you do talk about some amazing examples of forgiveness, of public forgiveness, one of them being Bud Welch, who many people heard about after the Oklahoma City bombings. His beloved daughter was killed, and he forgave Timothy McVeigh, got to know Timothy McVeigh's father. But I sometimes think that those kinds of examples that do make the news, like the bombing, also exalt forgiveness as something that's really beyond the reach of most of us most of the time. You know, we hope that we would be that gracious, perhaps, but it almost feels superhuman.
Right. And if you look at Bud Welch and you look at that story from the outside and you ask yourself, how can this man whose daughter was killed in this terrible explosion ever get over his rage. We, from the outside, we have a really hard time imagining that. But if you look at the story of Bud Welch, actually what you find is he had a lot of help along the way. Mm. And if you look at the story very carefully, you can actually learn a lot about how the human mind evolved to forgive and what kind of conditions activate that instinct in human minds. Because a lot of those a lot of those conditions ended up falling into place for Bud.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, he doesn't talk about forgiveness, even for himself in that case, as having been some massive struggle. I mean, perhaps it was, but I've read what I could about this extraordinary man.
Well, it
man.
Was an incremental also, wasn't it? I mean, it gets reported as an act, but in fact it was a process.
Yeah, that's right.
Mm-hmm.
And along the way, there were events that he actually made happen for himself that turned forgiveness into one of these things that can be easier. For example, as perhaps you know, he actually sought out Timothy McVeigh's father and visited him one day at the McVeigh home and had this moment, he describes, when he saw Timothy's picture on the mantle.
Mm-hmm.
It was a high school graduation picture. And they were just making small talk, and Bud said to McVeigh's father, he said, "God, that's a good-looking kid." And the tears just began pouring out of the elder McVeigh.
Mm-hmm.
And what he realized then was that here was another father on the verge of losing a son, or losing a child. And that immediate experience of sympathy and compassion went a tremendous way in facilitating the forgiveness process for Bud. And it so right off the bat, this real human interaction starts to turn forgiveness from something difficult to do to something that's easier to do, because this compassion has happened naturally in the course of real human interaction, and then suddenly forgiveness is a little easier.
So this is getting to one of the really important points I think you make with your work, that if we can understand this forgiveness instinct and how that even understanding it in terms of evolution, that we can start to create conditions where it can be empowered, right? So it's a fascinating idea, and I wonder how you would want to start talking about what that would look like if we started doing that collectively.
Right. I see five ingredients, okay, and that are necessary to take a human mind that is aggrieved, that is suffering because of harms it has suffered, and switch it over to a inclination to forgive. So I actually think there are these five slider switches in the mind. And if you can slide them in the directions of forgiveness, you'll get forgiveness even where you'd suspect from the outside that the desire for revenge was more likely.
Okay.
The first is safety. Human beings are naturally prone to forgive individuals that they feel safe around. So if we have an offender that is apologizing in a way that seems heartfelt and convincing and has really convinced us that they can't and won't harm us in the same way again, okay, that's a point for forgiveness, right? Point on the forgiveness side. Again, the human mind evolved for forgiveness to be something worth its while.
Mm-hmm.
And we're not likely to be an organism. Any successful organism is unlikely to have a mechanism in it that says, you know, just keep stepping on my neck. It's
right,
okay.
Right.
So, but if you can convince me that you're safe, right, that I don't have to worry about being harmed in the same way a second time, maybe I'm willing to move a little bit forward.
But it seems like that would be the hardest condition or assumption to put in place in the context of many of the worst cycles of revenge in our world.
Sometimes safety comes through things like the rule of law, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Sometimes safety comes through you as a small business owner dusting off that employee manual that you had somebody do for you a long time ago that you have to give out to your employees but you don't think about anymore, and asking yourself, what is in here that would instruct an employee on what to do if they were being systematically harassed by a coworker, mm-hmm. that would convince this employee that their grievance would be taken seriously, mm-hmm. that an investigation would happen, and that if there was a real serious infraction, it would be dealt with in a way that restored that employee's sense of safety, right? Mm-hmm. These are simple kinds of things that anybody can do, right? Mm-hmm. What can you do in your associations, that your condo association, you know, mm-hmm. when somebody has a grievance? What do you have in place that makes people feel secure that when the neighbor has a band that he's hired for a party playing at 12:30 on a Friday night, that you know how to make sure that doesn't happen a second time, right? Okay. So that you don't then have to say, well, I'm going to get back at that guy myself.
Right.
I'm going to leave my garbage cans out all weekend long, which I know he hates, right? If you feel
you're
secure,
talking about revenge in ordinary life, which is where I think we're more comfortable talking about it in terms of warring tribes across the globe.
Yeah. Right? Well, I can take it in any – I mean, the thing I like about these principles is they're mm-hmm. scalable, right? Uh-huh. Uh-huh. So we can talk – actually, usually people – When people ask me about the book, they're actually less interested in the geopolitical stuff.
Okay.
But I can, you know.
Okay. Well, we'll get there. So
yeah.
What's the second after safety?
Value. We are inclined to forgive individuals who are likely to have benefit for us in the future. So we find it really easy, as I was saying, to forgive our loved ones or forgive our friends or forgive our neighbors or our business partners, because there's something in it for us in the future, mm-hmm. right? And the costs sometimes of destroying a relationship that's been damaged are just too high, because establishing a new one is so difficult to do. Mm-hmm. So relationships that have value in them are ones in which we're naturally prone to forgive. Now, I know what you're thinking. How do you take a valueless relationship and put value in it? Because sometimes when we're harmed by somebody, it's a relationship that we don't care about.
Yeah, I mean, I'm really struck by you talk about this core principle that operates, and it makes sense that forgiving someone you don't like or who's different from you or who you don't feel close to is much more difficult than forgiving a friend or someone who's like you. Or someone you're close to.
Yeah, yeah. So people say, well, how do you take that and use that? Here's what I want to know. What happens if some entrepreneur comes along, some Bill Gates type, and says, I'm going to go to some part of the world that is rent by ethnic violence or violence between small villages or mm-hmm. tribes or clans, and says, these people are at war. They have been at war for ages. And they're also struggling economically. So what I'm going to do is make small micro grants available to individuals who are entrepreneurs wanting to start small businesses, who could do a lot with $200 or $300. But I want to make other small grants available as incentives that will give them extra funds to work with if they can establish a business partnership with an entrepreneur from this other group that they've been warring against for so long, right? Mm-hmm. I want to know what's wrong with that idea.
It sounds like an XPRIZE proposal to me.
Yeah, I want somebody to tell me why that doesn't work, mm-hmm. why you can't take entrepreneurs who want to feed their families, that want to have high standards of living, and tell me why they wouldn't find incentive in establishing business relationships with individuals from these other groups if there's something in it for them that makes these relationships valuable to them. Because I think this is an engine for getting over grievances from the past for the sake of doing business.
Well, I think it sounds cynical, and perhaps because we want forgiveness to be something beautiful. It almost sounds inauthentic in terms of the way perhaps we think about what forgiveness is.
Yeah, you may be right, and I think perhaps that's because we want it to be something really magical and to hit us like a bolt out of the blue. And I don't
And you
think...
want us to tap into what in us is hardwired to do it.
Exactly. Uh-huh. That's exactly right. Mm-hmm. So I look around the world and what I see is I think that people are often very willing to put their grievances aside when they can't do better than doing just that, right? When that's the best course of action, when they can make a livelihood for themselves by putting those old grievances aside.
Okay, now I know you have three other points, but let's talk about this in terms of concrete challenges and, you know, maybe bring those in. So here's something that's really on my mind right now, and we're in an election year. Some of these, for lack of a better phrase, the phrase we've been using for a few years, moral values issues, right? Mm-hmm. You know, disagreements around, in particular, around issues of human life and human sexuality, abortion and homosexuality, where it's not just that that our political life is divided along these lines. It's that religious denominations are being torn apart from the inside around them. It's that people can't talk about this around the Thanksgiving table with their relatives, right?
Yeah.
I've heard so many stories about, they either don't talk about it. If they do talk about these things, an incredible anger arises, and and these cycles of anger play themselves out. So, I wonder, as you watch that, and you're in the South, you're in a politically charged state. How do some of these things you think about in terms of forgiveness, what runs through your mind when you think about how we might come to any kind of resolution on some of these really intimate, difficult, divisive issues?
Well, I think we had a wonderful opportunity to do a lot of this after 9/11. Hmm. It's the old saw. Right, if the planet were invaded by aliens tomorrow, all of a sudden we'd have an end to all the world wars, right? Because we'd have another problem to sort out, and it would be so much larger than we could solve, and still maintain our grievances with each other. So we'd put those aside. I think that
so maybe climate change will supersede abortion as a divisive issue.
Climate change could do it, right? I mean, I think on a lot of these thorny cultural divides, what buys you forgiveness or goodwill or tolerance is to emphasize the commonalities, right? And when people have their ability to remember those commonalities or remember those common goals, they can have civil debates, right? I was pretty touched to read about what happened at the Democratic National Convention with the delegates from Illinois. Evidently, in Illinois, they've been having a couple of pretty bad years of gridlock because of animosity among some of the actors.
Over
budgetary matters. Uh-huh. A lot of it evidently was personality driven, but there's been a lot of bad blood, and this bad blood has led to some pretty unproductive politics in Illinois for a couple of years. But somehow, when they got to the convention and started meeting just their own delegation from Illinois, some speeches were made at the podium. And ultimately, one of the speakers got up and felt some conviction to ask for forgiveness from some of his old political enemies. And by what I've read, it sounds like there was just sort of this Niagara Falls of tears and embracing and reconciliation and apologies and hugging and kind of this overwhelming desire to reconcile despite these many years of personal grievances with each other inside Illinois. So to me, what I think's going on there is that they get to the convention and they say, we are still members of this single party. We still care about the future of the United States. We care about the future of Illinois. And let's put – and all of a sudden, things that they can't control start coming out of their mouths. Hmm. Please forgive me. I'm sorry for what I said to you. I'm sorry for how I've been attacking you for the last few years. Let's reconcile. And so wonderful things can happen when people – have to come together to, again, to cooperate, to solve problems. These people want to win the presidential election in 10 weeks. And I tend to think that the desire to cooperate and the need to cooperate kind of overwhelmed them a couple of days ago, and they decided to mend these fences and try to heal these wounds.
Mm-hmm. But a lot of these bitter moral divides in U.S. culture right now happen across, we are divided in terms of along partisan lines. And so even that, you know, now these will still be two, you know, so to the extent that people who are on different sides of some of these issues fall, become, they are either part of the Republican campaign or the Democratic campaign. And so the divide is perpetuated through the election.
Yeah. There may be a time when the value of a politics of goodwill can be sort of broadly seen again. And until then, we probably are going to do a lot of what we've been doing, which is trying to accentuate the differences rather than accentuate the commonalities that have differences sort of in the middle of them.
And what is it in us as human beings that drives us to accentuate the differences? What do you understand about that from your work?
Well, we do have a hard time seeing things from other people's perspectives. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And we tend to view other people who have positions different from ours as having much more similarity to each other than we do. We can see the great variety in our own positions, right?
Oh, so, but we can't see the variety in other people's positions.
No, that's right.
That's interesting.
Uh-huh. Yeah, we tend to paint them with the same brush.
Okay.
And so we tend to really simplify positions that other groups have or people on other sides of positions. So we have a simplified view. We tend to actually view them as more partisan and more extreme on average than the average really seems to be.
Huh.
And so there's something about how the mind works and how it processes groups, right? When we think about people from over there, that other group,
right,
that kind of causes us to not really view them with the same sort of humanity that we afford our own groups. You know, you think about an issue you feel strongly about and that you know a lot about, and you can say, well, actually, there's a lot of people who have sort of different views than mine. They're not exactly the same. And that allows you to view them as human beings, right?
Right.
Harder to do something about the limitations of the mind, or perhaps because of how the mind was actually designed to work, we have a harder time affording that kind of benefit of the doubt to other groups. So if we know that, then
if we know that, you know, about ourselves, right, if we can have an, you're saying if we can get an awareness about that, perhaps that is a beginning.
then you can begin to say, well, they're just a group of human beings, too, trying to muddle their way through a position that's going to work for them. Hmm. And, you know, maybe that kind of recognition of their diversity as well can help. And also the recognition that there are many positions that are less moderate than we think they all hold.
Right.
Then maybe we'll have less anxiety about interacting in a civil way.
Hmm. You know, I mean, just to kind of go to the geopolitical level, You tell some stories about, let's say, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, where you have, you know, cycles, generations of grievance and revenge kind of layered on top of each other. And yet you tell stories, and we've all heard these kinds of stories, and I've met some of these people who are, you know, amazing, who have still moved beyond that in themselves, have reached out to people on the other side, have formed just what you said, have seen, have come to see the other group as human, and have formed friendship. And those kinds of stories don't tend to be in the headlines. I mean, we hear the headlines of continued violence and continued animosity, right?
Right.
But from the studies you've seen, or from what you know about how these things play themselves out in different societies, I mean, what does it take? Is it possible, even, say, in the Israeli-Palestinian crisis, that one day those networks reach such a critical mass that they, that the balance is shifted? I mean, does it work that way? How does that kind of collective change really happen?
Some of it happens when people become too tired to fight, right? Or too...
Yeah, you tell that story in northern Uganda, right?
Yeah.
You said there's an epidemic of forgiveness that's grown out of fatigue as much as anything else.
That's right. That's right. Sometimes the costs of maintaining grievances are so high that individuals and their groups will decide that they've pushed themselves to the brink. They've demonstrated their insistence on defending themselves, and they've shown that they will defend themselves to the end. And having done that, It becomes possible to try to find a new way. So, also, though, I think... Go ahead.
Well, I was just saying, would you tell the story of what's happening in northern Uganda? Is that example?
So there's a group there called the Acholi, who... actually, let me start over. Mm-hmm. So Uganda has been at war for many years. And part of the strategy of one of the rebel groups has been to it's a group called the Lord's Resistance Army, and it's headed by a man named Joseph Kony, and who's kind of a strange, shrouded figure, actually, kind of a very unusual character. Kind of sees himself as playing sort of a messianic role, as I understand it. Part of their strategy has been to abduct children, boys and girls, from their villages and from their tribes, and take them off into the woods and essentially brainwash them. And
yeah, but
send
they've
them,
also had the children do horrible things, right, before they leave, so that they can't killing their own siblings, so that they can't go back. They're so ashamed that their parents won't take them back, right? It's terrible.
They send them back to kill their own families, right, to kill members of their own villages, their own tribes, to maim them, to disfigure people unrecognizably, to cut off their lips and ears and noses. They give the girls as child brides, mm-hmm, to the soldiers, and through this really heartless, brutal tactic, you know, they do a couple of things. One is that they destroy the culture, mm-hmm, of these villages. They destroy their, you know, the fabric of their own history, and they also create new foot soldiers for their army. The costs of this have been so high, both from a security point of view and from a cultural point of view, that many of the rank and file, just regular people living in Uganda, particularly this one group called the Acholi, have just simply grown so tired of these cycles of violence and their inability to solve them using military force, that they've been really pressing the government to offer amnesty, official amnesty, not only to Kony, but they've been offering unofficial amnesty to any of the children, any of the sons and daughters of their own villages who've been spirited away like this and brainwashed and turned into killers. And they've used radio programs, radio broadcasts, word of mouth, newspapers, really any vehicle they can get hold of to send this message out that if you will come back to your village, lay down your arms, meet with the elders, meet with the community, and work out a plan for demonstrating your desire to rejoin us, we'll let you rejoin us as a member of our community in good standing.
And they've been
coming back in groups as large as 300, 400, 500, 900, laying down their guns, working out plans for reparation, right? Trying to find some way to compensate victims for the harms they've caused. At risk to themselves, mind you. I mean, these returnees now have to worry about these villagers' own desires for revenge against them. Right. So they take a risk in coming back, and yet many of them are doing it. And in part, it really is because there just isn't another way. They haven't found a reasonable alternative to simply offering these people access to the old ways of solving grievances.
Do you think that this kind of development is inspired, empowered by, say, the example the Truth and Reconciliation Commission set in South Africa?
Yeah, that's been a huge
factor. New paradigm in the world.
Right. What happened in South Africa with the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, and also the amount of attention it received in the international media, mind you, has meant that nations that have been destroyed by civil wars now see a mechanism, a formal mechanism that doesn't require a trustworthy sort of central government in order to achieve healing. Huh. And what I mean by that is a lot of times you can't simply, when you have a civil war, you can't simply run war criminals through the old criminal justice system because it's not trusted.
Right.
No, it's the establishment itself and citizens don't trust it. So what the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa managed to do was to use an informal process. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the government was involved, but it was a process that involved lots of input from civilians to give individual victims opportunities to meet with their perpetrators, the people that were responsible for killing their loved ones, hauling them away and taking away their property, imprisoning them, and so forth. And by offering some degree of leniency often to these perpetrators, the victims were able to get some truth, right? They were able to get laid down in an official record what happened, what were the crimes that were committed, so that there can't be any denial of them again.
And, you know, what was striking to me in reading your research, like what we are learning from psychological research and brain science is how the Truth and Reconciliation was so compatible with that, right? First of all, this very central assumption they made, awareness that victims and that we all have the capacity within us to be both victims and perperpetrators, right? What you're describing, that revenge, that this capacity for revenge, that we're all hardwired for that. And then also, I mean, I've interviewed people who were on the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, including a psychologist, and this notion of Ubuntu, of the interconnected humanity, which really came to the surface, you know. So speaking to that, to what you've talked about, this essential element in forgiveness is that it's so much easier to forgive people to whom we feel we are, with whom we feel we are in relationship.
Right.
And the South Africans were able to surface that feeling almost nationally. And it really, it jives with everything you've told me about what we're learning scientifically.
It's so interesting how some of these these informal interventions that people come up with really match well with how the mind seems to have been outfitted with a forgiveness instinct.
Well, and really, if you think of it, there should be some instinct towards that, shouldn't there? I mean, whether we've known how to describe it or not.
That's right. That's right. And again, you know, I think you're right to point at the Truth and Reconciliation Commission for its ingenuity in this way. What it did recognize is that people are have an appetite for just desserts, right? Mm-hmm. And the Truth and Reconciliation Commission did not deny that.
And that people who have been harmed can then become capable of the same kinds of doing the same kinds of violence.
That's right. Mm-hmm. That's right. And they didn't give free passes. Mm-hmm. This is important. Truth and Reconciliation Commissions, although they might offer incentives to perpetrators to come and explain what they did and literally where the bodies are buried in some cases, they don't get get out of jail free cards. Right? Mm-hmm. People still experience jail. They still have jail time before them. Sometimes hard time. And even those who maybe get off without imprisonment, you know, they lose their impunity. They lose their moral standing. They have to sacrifice their image in the world as morally blameless creatures. Mm-hmm. They have to admit what they've done. So they lose a lot. They sacrifice a lot. They don't lose a loved one like the victims do. But there are costs. And I think it's important to emphasize that those costs mean something to victims, to know mm-hmm. that a perpetrator has had to do some suffering themselves actually goes some distance towards satisfying that brain's craving, but short of full revenge.
Mm-hmm. You know, we have about 10 or 15 minutes left, and I'd like to try to be really concrete in this time we have left in terms of practical steps for people who are listening.
Yeah.
You know, you know a lot on the basis of, you know, case studies and science and, you know, what place could this word forgiveness have in how we think about the war on terror or, what is going to continue to unfold in Iraq?
Right. Well, you want to start at the practical how-tos for individual life, or
with Iraq and then go to the practical how-tos for life?
Okay, sure. Well, I mean, one of the things that's going to happen in Iraq is that government is going to get stabilized, and if the government there gets stabilized and on its feet again, it's going to begin to be effective again at enforcing the rule of law. Mm-hmm. Our biggest problem in Iraq right now, as lots of people are aware, is the infighting among factions and sects and old tribal groups for power. Mm-hmm. So when we came in and disrupted the existing power base, what it did is it caused people to turn back to those old tribal alliances for security.
Right. This is a really interesting point you make, that strong governments, and it cuts both directions, even repressive governments squelch or kind of take on all that revenge function, right?
That's right.
And so, and that helps me understand why sometimes when you have terrible regimes fall apart, the Soviet Union or Saddam Hussein's regime, even in South Africa, some of these rivalries, these kind of primitive rivalries, if you want to call it that, come to the surface.
That's right. I like to ask people to look out their windows in their office or their homes and imagine what your life would look like if the police and the National Guard and the fire department and the paramedics stopped working tomorrow because of a natural disaster. How would you? People are hungry. People are they have needs, and how would you put security into place yourself? What you would do is you would probably find your friends and find your family, and you'd circle the wagons. Hmm. People are going to create some kind of structures around themselves for maintaining security when governments can't do that for them.
Okay.
So in Iraq, that's what we're seeing. We're seeing we replaced one of the truly awful dictators of the late 20th century when we removed Saddam Hussein. However, he was repressive.
Mm-hmm.
He killed thousands and thousands of his own people. You know the story there. And yet, it is also true that when we did that, and particularly when we disbanded the army, we did away with the only structure that was capable of holding a lot of very old tribal and ethnic and sectarian grudges in check.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah. So you're saying that the best thing we, America, could do to foster the flourishing of this lovely virtue of forgiveness in Iraq is support the creation of a strong, stable government.
I think that is what is called for there.
Mm.
I mean the thing about Iraq, as I understand it, and I don't profess to be an expert by any means, is that it's had wonderful periods of peace,
mm-hmm.
wonderful periods of people cooperating and coexisting, despite all of these differences that we're talking about today, because they were safe. They could live the lives they wanted with respect, and they could thrive and experience economic growth. And they had all the wonderful things that we enjoy today here in the United States that also allow us to have a high level of tolerance for
mm-hmm.
each other.
Mm-hmm.
So that same level of tolerance can be brought back. It's not as if that's a part of Iraq's history that it will never see again. It will see it again if the right institutions can be put back together.
So, in terms of what average people can do in the course of more ordinary lives, let me ask you the question this way: I mean, how do you think you live differently? How do you conduct yourself differently with people you fundamentally disagree with on important social issues, with irritating people at work? How do you conduct yourself differently because of this, what you know scientifically and this research you do?
Yeah, the thing that I have realized is that you can many times if you've been harmed by somebody, you don't have any choice but to try to forgive it on your own, because the person's gone, the person's dead,
mm-hmm.
the person will have nothing to do with you.
Right.
There's just no bridge there. But in lots and lots of cases, forgiveness is just a conversation away. I mean, there are so many people, if you ask them about the hurt that they remember from junior high or high school, what you often find is there was never any conversation back with that person who harmed them.
Right.
And so the conclusion I've come to is, in many, many cases, if you want forgiveness, if you want to forgive, or if you want to be forgiven, you need to go out there and get it for yourself. And the way you go out and get it for yourself is by trying to have the kind of conversation with the person you hurt that you want to have. In my family, we apologize about a lot.
Apology is an important concept for you. You say that it really, even biologically, it's important for us.
Apology is really important because that's when I apologize to you for something I've done, you see me squirming. You see me uncomfortable. You see me trying to reassure you that I'm not going to harm you in the same way again. You see me giving you respect as a human being with feelings. And all of a sudden, I've turned on a lot of the slider switches that make forgiveness happen in your head.
It's almost also that you've made it the next best thing to revenge.
That's right. That's right.
It's because fulfilled some of those needs we have.
There are so many people mm-hmm. who, once they see someone who's harmed them cry and experience shame and experience humiliation for the way they behaved, suddenly it's the forgiver who's doing the healing, right? Mm-hmm. Who's reaching out to the perpetrator. This happens so many times. All people often need is this kind of vigorous conversation about the past. Now, this isn't this. If this were so easy, people would have been doing it already.
Right,
so,
right.
So I don't pretend that. But at the same time, I really think we can't lose sight of the value of kind of getting in each other's business a little bit and getting in each other's lives a little bit and being willing to try to make things a little bit uncomfortable and a little bit messy in the service of making them better.
Hmm. I've wondered, as I was reading your work, just about this basic principle that it does become easier to forgive when there is a human relationship, when you perceive that you are connected to another person in some way, and that relationship has value. I've wondered if this new generation coming up is going to be perhaps better equipped, whether they're going to kind of bring an evolutionary step forward, just because the world, you know, interconnectedness is not an abstract concept anymore in so many ways to the young.
Right. I mean, that's one direction it can go. One direction is that we see easier and easier communication happening so that it is easier and easier to reach out to people who seem different from you or who are on the other side of the planet. And so that's bound to put a check in the forgiveness side of the scorecard. But it has to be interconnectedness of a certain kind. I mean, you know, the things that appeal to the human mind and its instinct to forgive have some flesh and bone to them, right?
Say some more.
Well, we need to see emotion, right? Emotions go a long way in appealing to the forgiveness instinct.
Okay.
I mean, words can do that, right? You can type an email and make that happen.
Yeah.
But there are certain things about expressions of shame and embarrassment that you can pick up on the face. And when people know that somebody's a perpetrator is experiencing these emotions, it tells you that, hey, I can trust this person's intentions in the future because they really are aggrieved by their behavior from the past.
Mm-hmm.
So people can be really lenient and really forgiving and really tolerant when they know that a perpetrator is not faking it, is not going through the motions. So interconnectedness is great. But it's also got to have that it's got to have that connection to flesh and blood as well, I think.
And what about how do conditions get created for people to forgive even when the perpetrator is not going to apologize and is not going to squirm and be ashamed?
Krista, can I say one more thing about interconnectedness?
Sure. Uh-huh.
There's another thing about interconnectedness that's really important, and one of the things that seems to be favoring more cooperation in human beings' future is that we're more cosmopolitan than ever. Mm. We have so much experience with people from other cultures that even 50 years ago would have just been unheard of.
Right.
You know, that 200 years ago would have been the stuff of fairy tale.
Yeah.
I mean, the fact that we can easily communicate with people on the other side of the world, that the prices of travel have dropped as dramatically as they have, our ability to sink ourselves into fiction because there's translations of, great modern works of fiction in Arabic and in French, in every language. It's all here for us that we can experience many different ways of life in a way that's really unprecedented. And that kind of ability to relate to get into the heads of people from other societies, I think really is leading to a future in which strangers can't be quickly and easily assigned over to the enemy's pile.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm very optimistic that our future holds much easier forgiveness for us because we are more worldly and we are more interconnected than we've ever been.
And I mean, I sense, again, when if you just read the headlines, you read about what's going wrong in the world today. What are the worst, most entrenched crises? I do sense from your research where you kind of try to take a global view and look at civil wars that have happened in recent years that have been resolved. I mean, that you kind of feel that there is progress, that on balance, there's more reconciliation happening. Is that right? Is that?
Yeah. Go ahead.
It's hard. Well, it's hard to get that impression just as a layperson just reading the newspaper.
Right. I mean, I'm so optimistic about our future because if you look at that long arc of history, as you suggest, what you see is, for example, the homicide rate. We worry about the homicide rate, as we should. It goes up some years, it goes down other years, and we worry. But over the long arc of history, you take Western Europe, homicide rates are a 20th, and in some countries a 50th of what they were 600-800 years ago, right? So if we take this long perspective, what it seems to be happening is actually we're getting better and better control over human beings' potential for aggressiveness. And a lot of that homicide 600-800 years ago was in fact vengeance motivated. Mm-hmm. But when we get control of those instincts and we give people other tools to deal with their grievances, they will restrain themselves. So Iraq may look dismal to some. It's certainly unpleasant, and it's been terrible for our country and the world in so many ways. And yet I see coming out of it, whenever that is, a society that's going to rebuild itself into a peaceful society. I don't know how long it will take. It's above my pay grade, as they say. But this is what societies tend to do. They tend to find the best way for to rebuild in the aftermath of these kinds of collapses in ways that will promote cooperation.
And you're really saying that on the basis of lots of research, aren't you? I mean, case studies and science and social scientific research. This is not just wishful thinking. I mean,
if you put societal structures in place where people feel their rights are protected, and they feel that they see a way forward for making a living in a peaceful way, and you put mm-hmm. incentives in place like that where there's security, they prefer peace over war. Mm-hmm. Every time. Mm-hmm. So we know how to do that. I don't have strong beliefs, for example, about free trade because of some ideological background of mine. I'm just mm-hmm. a psychologist working in a lab. But I have become such a fan of free trade. And not the free trade that we pretend we sometimes have now, because mm-hmm. we don't really have it. We have free trade with lots of exceptions. But when people can tie up their economic fate with the economic fate of another country, it just isn't in their interest, their self-interest, to hurl bombs at each other.
Right. And there's one of those geopolitical economic realities that, again, bears out some of the basic things you're learning about when our forgiveness instinct can be activated biologically.
You're tolerant. We're tolerant and forgiving when we're dealing with other actors that mm-hmm. we depend on for our own well-being. Mm-hmm. And we'll do it with smiles on our faces. I mean, this isn't grit your teeth and forgive.
Right, right.
This is, we kind of like those people, right? Mm-hmm. You know, we get along with them. We like their minivans. They like the services we provide. They like our agriculture. We like their milk. You know, these seem like really basic kinds of considerations. But you can build self-interest. You can build concern for others out of these really simple parts, mm-hmm. because I think this is what the mind was designed to do.
Hmm. Just my last question: what seems really important to you? You said you have a 7-year-old son. You have one child.
So what, we have two, actually.
Two. So what, from all the everything you know, I mean, what feels really important for you to pass on to your children practically?
Yeah, I mean, I have a 4-year-old daughter who's a little bit too young for this still, but with our 7-year-old, I really have tried to encourage him to be vigorous about acknowledging his mistakes and the harms that he causes his friends, and whether that's just a careless word or excluding somebody from a game or whatever, because so much of forgiveness comes down to interaction. It comes down to knowing that an offender is not the person you thought he was when he hurt you or she was when she hurt you. Mm. It's changing that perception. So I try to it's simple things, but we try to teach him that what someone needs after they've had their feelings hurt. And we think if we can explain to him what the mind needs after someone's been offended, then we can teach him how to be vigorous and not worry about looking having to look like he's right all the time, right, or having to look like he's perfect, or denying his mistakes. If he can own up to them, that's a vigorous, healthy way to keep his friendships intact.
I have a couple quick questions from behind the glass. Did you want to say something else? I wasn't sure if I cut you off. Hello?
Oh, no. I'm here.
Okay.
I'm good right now.
Okay. All right. Let me get this behind the glass and I'll see what it was that I...
Yeah.
I know. Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay. I don't know if we can do that right now. Yeah. I just don't think... Yeah. Something came to me while you were saying that, and I don't know what it was. Oh, I know. So can forgiveness be measured in the brain the way revenge can be measured in the brain?
Yeah, we aren't there yet. Just because violence has been the more interesting topic for social scientists, I guess, than the more tender parts of human nature.
Okay.
But I suspect what we're going to see is when we get that forgiveness in the laboratory and we can look at forgiveness in the brain. Well, if I had to tell you my hunch, I'd suspect we'd see a brain that is experiencing the same kind of prospect of reward, but not being driven by the desire to harm, right?
Mm-hmm.
There'd
mm-hmm.
be reward from harming, but reward from restoring relationship.
Mm-hmm.
So it would look a little bit like a brain on revenge, but being driven by the prospect of a different kind of reward, the reward that comes from reconnecting with an old friend or getting a business relationship back on track, or the satisfaction that comes from knowing that your kids went to bed happy after having spent the last 20 minutes clobbering each other.
right. So, I think a simplistic view, and you kind of touch on this in your book, of what religion can do in terms of forgiveness is, I think there's been a sense that, say, for example, that maybe Christianity, invented forgiveness, offers forgiveness to the world. And when I look at all your research and have this conversation with you, it seems to me that in terms of where religion can play a constructive role in this, and religion is also often implicated in places where there's terrible violence going on, but is perhaps not in the first instance teaching forgiveness, but some of the teachings that come out of religious traditions about caring for the other, about caring for the stranger.
That's right. Yeah, absolutely. I think one of the best things we can do with religious faith is give people an appetite for difference. And the major world religions all have the resources for doing this, mm-hmm. for getting people excited about people who are different from them.
Yeah.
It's not every brand, right, that exercises that prerogative. But in the scriptures and traditions of every world religion that has been successful on a grand scale, there is a story there about the love of difference,
mm-hmm. and compassion towards difference.
Right, compassion toward difference, mm-hmm. Caring for the strangers in your midst, mm-hmm. Being able to see beyond superficial differences toward the essential commonalities.
Right.
Religion is also good at speaking to people, appealing to people's meaner sides and the more brutish side, and the resources are there for both. So it's really up to those people who have a passion for reconciliation in their own faiths, mm-hmm. to make sure that the right tones are struck and the others are a little bit more muted.
Something that I've been aware of also is that this word forgiveness, I think, has a really Christian ring in many ears, but I've been very intrigued at, you know, I remember speaking with a Holocaust survivor who said that, you know, for him, the word forgiveness just didn't do it. And it has this cultural connotation of forgive and forget, but the Jewish phrase repair the world, you know, compels him in the same way he feels the word forgiveness compels Christians.
I like that. I like that. I wish we could come up with a completely new word for what this human trait is.
Other than forgiveness?
Yeah, or maybe find some new way to talk about it so that we can unload a little bit of the baggage from the past, mm-hmm. because some of the baggage is that it's sort of a namby-pamby thing that doormats do or wimps do, or you know, only sort of milquetoast types of people are interested in. But from everything I've managed to read and see and understand in my own work and in the course of working on Beyond Revenge, it's that forgiveness is a brawny, muscular exercise that I kind of imagine sort of a Falstaff sort of character, someone with a great passion for life and a great sort of hearty sort of disposition, kind of being able to take on.
Wow. And you really feel that it's essential to our geopolitical future, right, as well as the health of our individual lives.
It's just too important. Yeah, mm-hmm. It's just too important. And the doors are open now. Mm-hmm. The doors are open for the use of this kind of language in the public sphere. Mm-hmm.
Great. Well, those are wonderful last words. I kept you a little while, but it's a terrific conversation. So,
Did that work for you?
Yeah, it worked for me.
You got some stuff you can work with? Okay.
Yeah.
Great.
I don't know who you've been... you've been talking to Colleen, our producer,
yeah.
Colleen. So we may have some questions, and she'll be in touch with you, and she'll let you know what's happening with this, and so we'll keep you completely on track.
That sounds great.
Okay. Thank you so much.
It was a pleasure. I enjoyed it.
Yeah, great. I did too.
Thanks, Krista. Bye now.